Coming up on Tech News Today, Instagram lifted one of the last vestiges of Snapchat's uniqueness. We'll talk about that. Also, HTC introduced a phone you can squeeze. Facebook keeps misreporting its ad measurements. BizStone is heading back to Twitter. And Mark Cuban has a hoverboard he wants to sell you. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1769, recorded Tuesday, May 16th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT.
And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get 3 meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about all the biggest tech news stories with people who are passionate about technology. I'm Jason Howell.
And I'm Nathan Olivares-Giles. And we're going to start things off here with Instagram. Once again. Shamelessly.
I think this is it. I think there are no more features.
They'll find more. Shamelessly ripping off Snapchat and some of their features with what it calls face filters. This is great. This works just as it does on Snapchat. You just open the app, hold up your phone, go into the selfie camera, and you see some filters that you can put over your face. There are things to choose from, like a golden wreath on your head, different princess and king crowns. There's ears and noses from a koala bear or a bunny rabbit, which is different than the puppy dog that Snapchat has. So they're not taking everything from Snapchat. Let's be clear here. We want to be fair. But this works with either one or two people's faces at a time. And unlike Snapchat, there are no face filters so far tied to advertisers or brands. So nothing tied to a movie or a sporting event or a new product launch yet. Seems like that'll be only a matter of time.
Yeah, that's the next feature. I was wrong when I said they've ran out of features to copy. That's the next thing.
Where it's going. That's got to be where it's going, right? But I don't know if you've got a chance to play around with this a little bit. I got a chance to try it out. And, there you go.
The glasses don't look that bad.
They don't look bad at all.
What's weird is when I shared this, because I rarely ever use Instagram, when I shared this, it like cut off all the stuff above my head, like the EMC squared stuff that's supposedly swirling around my head. I don't know why I did that. It's probably user error, but.
No, it's not. This is one of the things that kind of drives me nuts about Instagram. I really love using Instagram. It's one of the social media apps that I enjoy. But when you record video for that little live feed, their Snapchat, like, you know, thing, it always, when you try and bring it over, there's like a vertical mode, but it still crops it. It's like not as tall as it should be, but by default for these sorts of videos, it goes to square. So I haven't tried importing specifically the face filters, but any of the other video that I share to their stories, they call them stories.
Right.
It even if you go to the vertical orientation, it still crops it, which is a bummer because they're letting you, you know, they need to switch it up. They need to let you share the full visuals.
Well, especially if they're putting it all in there. You know, that was part of the thing. So like when I'm reacting in that video, even though it's square and you can't see it, I'm reacting to the stuff above me. When I do that, something appears.
Equations floating
but in that
air.
Post, you couldn't see it. So it just looks like I'm screaming for no reason. Whatever. That's
like a normal stressed out Jason day.
That's just pretty much any day of the week for me. I wondered if it was going to woo Megan because she uses Snapchat, but only for the filters.
Yeah.
She says, no, this is not going to pull her over. She's got a streak with Kara here at Twit and she's going to keep that going. So
it's, you know what? It's pretty fascinating. Clearly Facebook sees, and Facebook owns Instagram for those who don't know, Facebook sees Snapchat as a major, major threat. You know, major competitor.
Or a major pile of really good ideas.
Or, well, maybe a little bit of A, a little bit of B, a little bit of both. But there's just this audience of people who are so loyal to Snapchat. Yeah. They just love Snapchat. And so in some sense, I wonder if you know, keeping the people who haven't been exposed to Snapchat yet, who are just on Instagram and just Facebook,
mm-hmm.
if giving them these Snapchat-like features before they get to Snapchat, before they go and try out that other thing. And then when they get there, they're like, oh, I've already used all this. I've already got all this.
Right.
You know, they might not be following it as closely as we do. I wonder if it, in some sense it might be a tactic to keep people from leaving.
Right.
Rather than just necessarily like taking people away.
I think you're probably absolutely right with that. That actually makes a lot of sense when you consider the network effect that mm-hmm. Facebook and mm-hmm. Instagram has, the kind of, I mean, it's just massive user numbers in and of itself. Anyone that would want those features before might have to migrate over to Snapchat, but then you have to start from square one again. You have to build up your social graph, your connections, all that kind of stuff. Now it's like, well, you don't need to move over there. I have to say, as far as the filter is concerned, in my little time of playing around with it, in my experience of playing around with Snapchat filters, and then this one, I feel like this one was better at tracking your head. Like I could go, I could almost look entirely sideways and it would track it and it wouldn't lose it. On Snapchat, sometimes you do that and the thing will disappear. It'll like lose the tracking and kind of ghost away for a while and then come back when you look
back
forward.
That's a really good point. And I do wonder if Facebook's now years and years and years of facial recognition for tagging photos automatically, right?
Yeah, right.
And then their ability to like use some of that tracking data to build and facial recognition data to build out stuff with Oculus for VR. And now you need to use some facial recognition and facial tracking here. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have two separate companies that have been working on this stuff for a long time. And hey, you know, it's not as if Snapchat is brand new and just starting over, but you know, in about the time that Snapchat has existed as a whole, Facebook has been automatically tagging photos and recognizing your face. So it seems like, at least in that regard, Facebook should be better at this.
Yeah.
And it does seem like they are.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty nice. So I'll probably check it out once or twice more and then forget about it. Late last night, HTC introduced its next major flagship smartphone, the HTC U11, with some very unique features that we haven't seen in an Android phone to date. Not only does the phone have both Google Assistant and Amazon's I can't say it out loud, otherwise it gets beeped on the show.
I'm going to say it a couple times later, so mute your Echo speakers because we're going to say it.
Here we go. Amazon's Alexa layer, there we go, working underneath for dual wake word functionality. So both of them reside on the phone at the same time, depending on what your wake word is. But it also employs a squeezable frame around the lower half of the phone. It only works in the lower half of the phone. This allows users to program shortcut actions or assign apps to both short and long squeezes of the frame of the phone. So now you're squeezing your phone in order to launch apps. HTC is accepting pre-orders now. $649 in the U.S. Has the Snapdragon 835 processor.
Not
so
bad.
It's the most cutting-edge Snapdragon processor to date. This is absolutely HTC's next flagship phone.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty impressive. Little gimmicky, but I mean, all the early kind of insights, the first looks and everything from people have been super positive.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got to say, HTC, they used to be so popular.
Yeah.
They used to be such a big brand. Not so much anymore, but they still make some pretty great phones. And they've had some duds over the years, but some of the Android phones I like the most, you know, over the last decade, well, most of them come from HTC.
Yeah.
And they're full of great ideas. But the squeezing, I gotta say, it's like, you know how the iPhone has its Force Touch and 3D Touch?
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea, but not enough developers have really taken to it the way that I'd like to see. And this kind of reminds me of that. It's like, well, it's not a terrible idea that, you know, another level of depth, right? We're used to touch screens. Another level of depth to trigger some new features, not a bad thought. But why put on the lower half of the back of the phone and not just in the display? I don't understand why that would be the thing. I can't wait to squeeze one and try it out. I mean, it's kind of hilarious and it might even work well.
Yeah.
But why that? Like of all the places to squeeze on your phone.
I mean, well, you know? When you hold your phone, I'm only now looking at it. When I'm holding my phone, I'm always holding it on the bottom half. So maybe that's part of the reason why, right? Like it's this frame down the side.
Yeah, but you're likely going to squeeze with your thumb and your index finger, not like your pinky and your palm, right?
I don't know. So
it's not a comfortable.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see. You know, why would you want to do that? Why not just have like a shortcut button? This allows you to use that space and have two functions instead of just one, which you would get with a button. So, but it's basically the same thing. But B, you know, like gloves, for example, if you're wearing gloves and you want to do something like take a picture or I don't know, or wait a minute, there's usually a button for taking a picture. I don't know. But if you're wearing gloves, you know, you might not be able to do touchscreen stuff. So maybe that's a use case.
Could be. I like that HTC is willing to try something new.
For sure.
Do something different. Try out a new idea. But at the same time, unfortunately, I think the problem with HTC's sales isn't really that. I mean, they make good hardware. It's almost like more of like marketing and branding and Samsung and Apple, they just have far bigger marketing budgets than HTC or LG or, you know, a lot of others who don't do as well as they used to when it comes to selling their phones. So it seems like everything from the spec sheet here looks great. I'm guessing you're probably going to review one. I can't wait to see what, you know, get one in the office, see what everyone thinks about it. But gosh, you know, I don't think this is going to be the thing that's going to turn HTC's ship around.
Every year we're like, is this the phone that you know, HTC needed? And I think you're absolutely right. There's a bigger issue, and it's not just HTC's issue. It's pretty much any other manufacturer outside of Samsung and maybe Google in the Android space that has a hard time doing what Samsung and Apple have done with their phones because they just don't have the marketing prowess / dollars / whatever. That mind share is not there in the same way.
It's just
way,
not there.
And they don't have the money to take it there.
I'm glad you mentioned Google. I mean, the Pixel was a real hot seller when it first came out. I'm wondering where they're at now. I haven't really seen any data lately on that. I'm hoping they'll talk about it at I.O. later this week.
Yeah, I would hope so.
But, you know, Google trying to really position itself as a consumer tech brand. It's, you know, they've thrown a lot of marketing dollars behind the Pixel and Google Home. But you know, anecdotally, every time I go into, you know, different stores and stuff, there's lots of Pixels laying around. It's not as if this is a hard to come by device anymore.
It's all Samsung. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, that's the in demand Android device. That's the device that if you're not going into the store for an iPhone explicitly, you're probably going to get sold or pushed to buy a Samsung device. To some degree.
Even in spite of the battery problems they had last year.
Oh, yeah, totally. Hey, Samsung's not doing bad. I think they just released their numbers on the S8, and it's sold really, really well so far.
But the Pixel definitely seems to be like that kind of that other contender that we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, where it evolves.
The future isn't certain, but they've got a better chance than almost anybody, it seems like.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, advertisers flock to Facebook because nearly 2 billion people use the service, and that's a whole lot of eyeballs to get your ads in front of. But a problem is emerging over and over and over again. Facebook keeps overstating just how many people are seeing the ads that it's serving and how they're interacting with them. On Tuesday, Facebook admitted to its 10th measurement screw-up since September of last year. These mistakes, of course, can have consequences. In this case, advertisers were charged for clicks on a video carousel ads by smartphone web users that never actually happened. And this happened over the course of an entire year that they were basically charging for something that wasn't actually taking place. Marketing Land says that affected advertisers are being refunded some money as a result of Facebook coming clean on this. So this is kind of becoming like a recurring theme here. I mean, you know, 10 times since September last year, like that's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. I wonder at what point will advertisers start pulling ad dollars away. It doesn't seem to be happening at all yet.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, I was thinking about that too. But I mean, Facebook is just such a monster in the the marketplace. There aren't, you know, it's maybe Google and Facebook, and
that's about it.
And that's really about it to that size. Their ads, what were their ad sales? You know, they constitute most of their revenue on a yearly basis, $7.85 billion just last quarter alone, up 50% year over year.
Yeah.
So they just have this insane amount of leverage that I feel like they're kind of given, you know, a little bit of slack. I mean, I guess on the positive side, on the negative side, they keep having these mistakes, these misreporting errors. On the positive side, they keep being the ones that are coming out in front of it.
It's a good
point. Somebody else isn't calling them out and discovering it and being like, well, why didn't you do something about it? They keep kind of taking it in their own hands and doing make goods in order to kind of pick this up. In this case, from what I read, I couldn't tell if I was misreading it or not, but it said advertisers were charged a medium amount of around $10 over the year as a result of the error.
Yeah.
So the amount of money was...
Which isn't much, yeah, but if you have enough advertisers added up,
that's true.
That's not bad pocket change,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
Right? But yeah, Facebook did say that the error was very, very small. And that this affected 0.04% of carousel video ad impressions. And it was, again, specifically on those who are viewing these ads in their mobile web browser.
Right.
So not the app itself, which is the most popular version of Facebook out there. But yeah, basically this comes down to Facebook counting clicks the wrong way. When someone clicked on a video in the ad carousel to play it at full screen, Facebook was counting that as though advertisers, as though users were actually going to the advertiser's website when they weren't. And the thing that kind of drives me nuts about this is literally this is Facebook counting its own interactions. Like it's just keeping track of things that Facebook's own apps and software do. It's like literally like how many times does a user click something in what we make, and the fact that they can't track how their own software works to properly tell advertisers how it's working, that's troublesome to me, despite the fact that it happens over and over and over again.
Yeah,
it's just like, get it together. That you make your product. How do you not understand how your own thing works? You built it.
Time and time again.
Right? Time and time
again.
It
keeps happening.
To your benefit.
Yep.
But yeah, we'll see where this goes. In the past, they've miscounted on analytics software, ad impressions, video views, advertiser website referrals. So there's lots of different ways where they're getting this wrong.
They're getting it all out of the way. Next year will be perfect.
Next year.
100% perfect.
They sound like the Cubs. Next year, next year, next year. But hey, the Cubs won last year, so only
see,
took
it happens,
100 years.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Only took 100 years.
Apple's upcoming annual Worldwide Developers Conference begins June 5th, next month. For the first time in at least a few years, Apple is expected to announce new hardware at the event, at least according to Bloomberg sources, who say to expect three new laptops, with last year's MacBook Pro getting a bump to Intel's faster Kaby Lake. Is it Kaby Lake or Kaby Lake?
Against Kaby, I think.
Kaby Lake processor. I always get it wrong. The 12-inch MacBook also scoring a faster Intel processor, probably also a Kaby Lake. And the 13-inch MacBook Air getting some much-needed attention in the processor department. MacBook Air hasn't seen any sort of attention, I think, in quite a while. And we've just kind of fallen out of the routine of seeing hardware at WWDC. I don't think it's happened since 2014.
Yeah, it's been quite a while. I mean, you know, Apple kind of originated the whole idea of having events specific for product launches. I mean, they used to launch stuff at Macworld, which wasn't their own event.
Right.
You know, CES used to see a lot of product launches.
They don't even go to CES anymore.
Yeah. And so you're, and of course, Samsung does this now too, where they have their own events for hardware stuff. And in some ways, as a journalist, it's been kind of helpful where WWDC is really just about software. Mm-hmm. It's, hey, here are the things that are going to be coming to make the hardware that exists better. Here's the kind of vision on how people use what exists. But it would be kind of nice to see them switch it up a little bit, especially with a Microsoft recently coming out with what looks like, you know, could be some pretty impressive laptops, which are actually like Chromebook competitors at a MacBook price. So there's a lot of question marks about how good those laptops will be, but I really like to see, and there are some rumors to this, I'd really like to see a competitor to Amazon. I hope you have your Echo speakers on mute because I'm going to be saying this a couple more times. We've given you a fair warning. I'd like to see some competitors to Amazon's line of Echo speakers and to Google Home. That really seems like a space that they need to get into, especially with HomeKit and that kind of infrastructure being there. It's time to take the next step, I think.
Yeah, and there have been some rumors that we might possibly see a Siri speaker at the event, possibly even a 10.5-inch iPad Pro update. Who knows? I mean, that would be a lot of that. Just in all of those, that would be a very hardware heavy event. So I'd be surprised to see all of that stuff.
It would be a lot. But you know, recently Apple brought down a bunch of reporters to Cupertino.
That's right.
And said, hey, we're going to have more stuff coming from Mac later this year. We're going to have an update to the Mac Pro, which, you know, the beautiful cylindrical trash can
that didn't,
you know, device that it's gorgeous, but has it's been way too long since they've updated that.
Yep.
So they're being a little more open with their hardware plans, and they have been in a really, really long time. So, you know, we'll see where things go. Even if they don't talk, even if they don't actually show off some new hardware, it would be nice for them to talk about what's coming a little bit more.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to happen, but given how open they've been recently, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, Boy Genius Report also had a report that said that the iPad Mini is also kind of nearing the end. They have sources that say, yeah, they're kind of sizing it out of, you know, it sized itself out of its own category.
Oh, man.
It's filling a hole in the product category that now that there's a larger iPhone, doesn't need, you know, has little need for.
You know, that might be true, but I still really do love the iPad Mini. It's kind
of
great for like sitting on your couch, reading. It's a lot easier to carry around than the iPad Pro, which I do use an iPad Pro, but it's mostly like for drawing and actually working on. But yeah, I mean, how many Apple devices can you have in your home, right? If you got a big phone and you got a laptop, you probably don't need an iPad Mini too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, the first TV with Amazon's Fire TV software built in is here, and it'll be on sale soon. And it's from a low-end brand called Element, which actually makes your televisions in the U.S. The lineup starts at $449 for a 43-inch TV set, and it tops out at $899 for a 65-inch set. Like the Fire TV box or Fire TV stick, those who buy these TVs will get Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, Prime Video, and hundreds of other streaming apps, and the company's voice-controlled assistant, Skala, comes built in. Skala on these TVs can answer questions, control smart home appliances, pretty much do what it can do in any other iteration, but it can't yet be used to actually control your TV, like, say, switching HDMI inputs or something like that. One big difference: Amazon has built a channel guide interface specifically for the TVs that will let users of the new sets who are also using an antenna or a cable box view up to 14 days of live programming details.
Nice.
So if you're a big Amazon fan and you're looking for a cheap TV, this might be the way to go. What do you think?
Did you ever play around with the Amazon Fire TV, the Fire TV stick?
Yeah.
I really need to get my hands on one and check it out.
When it first came out, it was atrociously bad. The user interface was terrible. It was kind of slow and wonky. But I got to give Amazon some credit. They have been kind of updating their software and adding more capabilities. And it's not bad now. I mean, no TV OS is quite what I'd like it to be.
Right.
But it's come a long way. And, you know, now whether or not it could be the only thing you see when you turn your TV on, that's a bit of a question. But Roku TVs have been doing quite well.
Yeah.
And this really seems like a competitor for Roku TVs. Roku at this point has already signed up TCL, Sharp, Insignia, Hisense, and Hitachi. So for the low-end TVs out there, if you're going to buy a smart TV, you're probably going to end up buying a Roku TV. Or now here's this option from Amazon. But I do kind of wonder where do they have to go if those brands are doing that, and LG and Samsung have their own OS, and Sony and Vizio are running Google's
right.
Android TV.
Right.
I wonder where this is going to expand.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, this has been the year of Amazon's smart assistant who shall not be named. And so, I mean, I'm sure there will be some support. Maybe manufacturers support multiple
OSs.
Platforms? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Although that sounds a little confusing and messy.
Vizio has done some of that in the past, but not yeah. It's not really seen in TVs.
You'd really think that they would pick one and go for it. CNET had spent some time with the TVs, I think back in January. I think they were initially showing it off, and then they got to spend some time with it in May. They say push to talk, not always listening, so you don't get that always listening echo experience. Mm-hmm. It also doesn't talk to like the echoes that you have in your home cannot communicate with or control anything or pass information between them to the TV. So it is kind of isolated on its own as well.
I feel like that should be the sort of thing that they should be able to change in a software update for the televisions.
Yeah.
We don't know if that'll actually be the case. But I mean, you know, if the hardware is all there and it just comes down to a software problem, hopefully that's the sort of thing that can change in the future, because it is pretty great when you can, you know, you have a couple echoes around and you say that trigger word and it can recognize this is the one that's closest to you and respond appropriately and those sorts of things. But
and I mean, on the home side of things, if you have a Google Home and then you have a Chromecast connected to your TV, the ability of like saying, okay, G, play, you know, House of Cards on the TV in the living room.
That's
and
great.
It just fires up and you know, so that kind of cross device communication is really nice. And I'm sure Amazon will get that working.
It's probably some point. It seems like there are a couple things that are likely only a matter of time. It's that. It's actually controlling your entire television with your voice.
Yep.
So, you know, Amazon's voice assistant has a ways to grow. But as you said, this has been kind of the year of that assistant, especially at CES with all the different like third-party manufacturers getting into speakers and all these sorts of devices. So this that makes sense.
It's a good start.
Yeah, it's a good start.
All right, quick reminder that you can comment on anything we discuss by emailing tnt@twit.tv. You can also, of course, subscribe to the show at any time. Find TNT or Tech News Today on the web at twit.tv/TNT. Up next, Biz Stone is about to relive his glory days at Twitter. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They're the sponsor of this episode. Rocket Mortgage is perfect for you because you live your life on the internet. You live your life in the digital age. And, you know, at least I know for myself, the more I do things online in a digital sense, the less I want to actually like go, you know, do the longer step of going into a facility and sitting down and talk. I don't know. Maybe it's an antisocial aspect.
Especially when it comes to going into banks and that kind of thing.
Sometimes it's just easier to do all this stuff online.
Amen, brother.
Absolutely.
I'm right there with you.
And that's what Rocket Mortgage is kind of all about. It kind of it allows you to live more in the digital world. Not only that, you can trust them. They have your best interest in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. So you won't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can also play around with the numbers. That's a power that you have by doing this online. You can adjust the rate, the length of your loan in real time, and make sure that you can get the mortgage solution that's just right for you. So whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. So skip the bank, skip the waiting, go completely online. Go to quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. Twitter co-founder Biz Stone has been away from the Twitter game for quite a while, but today announced that he'll be returning to the company. Joining us to discuss what this means for Twitter is Kurt Wagner from Recode. How's it going, Kurt?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Doing awesome. Even better now that you're here. We appreciate you joining us. First things first, aside from being the co-founder of Twitter along with Jack Dorsey, what initially did Biz bring to the table during his time with the company? What was he known for back then?
Yeah, Biz obviously did a lot of stuff as co-founders do when companies are first getting off the ground. But the thing I always kind of thought of in terms of Biz's role, was really, you know, kind of being this public face of the company. He's a very positive, outspoken, super chatty guy. I think he dealt a lot with kind of the early press and early celebrities and getting the product into the right people's hands to kind of promote Twitter early on. And, you know, for those who have talked to Jack and Ev, they're a little bit more reserved and quiet. Biz is not that way. So I think, you know, as Twitter was kind of growing this platform and growing this publicity around itself, I think he was pretty central to that whole effort in the early days.
Then he stepped away, of course, back in 2011. He stepped out of his role at Twitter, kind of went to work on some of his own ventures. What are a few of those things and how have they done over the years? I know I've used Jelly, not very much, but I used it a little bit.
We all kind of used it because it was Biz's thing, right?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So Jelly started as this Q&A kind of app where you would go out and literally use it like an Ask Jeeves kind of thing, I guess, was the initial, maybe like a new form Google where you would ask it a question and then it would go out and actually find a human being to answer your question so that you were kind of connecting with humans to figure out the answers to whatever was going on in your life. then for a while, that kind of pivoted and it became this social network where you would share photos with like weird, funky glasses. And then that was short-lived. And he kind of came back to the Q&A thing and was like, hey, we need to make this work. This is our last chance. We're not going to keep wasting money if we can't figure this out. And then they sold it to Pinterest. And my understanding is the sell was more of a – I'm a little surprised, I guess, because of the Twitter thing, because my understanding was the sell was a little bit – felt more like an acqui-hire than anything.
Right.
I don't know how much of the technology Pinterest is actually going to use. And, you know, bringing in someone like Biz who had helped grow Twitter seemed like a logical thing. But now he's back at Twitter. So that's why I was a little surprised by what's happening today, because they had just announced this deal a few months ago for his startup to be, you know, acquired by Pinterest.
And he said on Medium he's back full-time, or he will be back full-time to Twitter. Do we know kind of what his role will be once he starts back here, I'm assuming in a few weeks?
Yeah, so he doesn't have an official title that I'm aware of. My understanding is he's going to report to the CMO, Leslie Berland, and it's the role is being described as kind of like a internal communications, internal morale, like how to get the company culture going again. For those who have spent time with Biz, I mean, he has an infectious personality. Like he can talk. I remember interviewing him about Jelly and being like, hey, man, what is this thing? Like, this is your third time going after it. And even then he's describing his struggles as an entrepreneur, and it makes you smile because just the way that he kind of tackles everything is with so much optimism. So I think, you know, if you're Twitter and you say, hey, we can bring back a co-founder, he's going to speak at all hands meetings, he's going to get people fired up, he's another voice of support for Jack, clearly. You know, maybe this is, who knows if he's even being paid. I don't know. I assume he is. But like, my guess is that this is just a way to kind of get things jump-started internally at the company. And I guess if you're going to have one co-founder come back and do that, Biz would be the guy.
What is the company morale like these days? Do you have any insight to that? I mean, you know, culture obviously is important and bleeds through pretty much everything, as we've seen with a lot of the troubles going on with Uber lately and a lot of the ways that culture has shaped, you know, Google and Facebook and Apple over the years. But what is Twitter's culture like, and essentially what does Biz need to fix or alter?
It's a good question. And I feel like part of the issue is that Twitter's culture, from my understanding, seems to change pretty regularly, right? I think it's hard to move quickly past the fact that they had layoffs for the second time in the fall. That until last quarter, when they kind of, you know, had a unexpected spike in user growth, like they had like five or six quarters in a row that were pretty big bummers for Wall Street. So you're sitting there, you're watching executives leave, you're watching the stock go down, you're watching your friends or your colleagues get laid off. Like this is what it has been like at Twitter for the last couple of years. You know, and even their product efforts, like this live video stuff, they get the NFL and then they lose the NFL, right? So I think that the culture is such that people are looking for some continuity. I think people are looking for some positive, you know, hey, are we going to make this as a standalone company, or is our future being acquired by some bigger entity? People on the outside don't know that, but I also don't think people on the inside know the answer to that. And so it's just an unsettling place. And when, you know, the top executives are leaving, as did kind of in the back half of 2016, I haven't noticed as many departures so far this year. But I just think it's hard to always have new bosses and new, you know, focuses for the company. So maybe Biz can, I don't know, it seems like too big of a job for one person to come in and all of a sudden change how people think about their own employer. I think that happens more with product direction and success as a company. Like a few more quarters of good success would probably do more than Biz could ever do, to be honest. But I think having someone with Jack's support, someone who's been there from the beginning, who truly, truly believes in Twitter, I think that's kind of what he brings.
It kind of made me laugh reading through the Medium post. There's a part of it where Biz says, you might even say the job description includes being Biz Stone.
Being Biz Stone.
Which I kind of had to roll my eyes a little bit. What exactly does that translate to? Is that kind of part of this, like, this aura that he brings with him, this kind of nice guy, unite people, bring everybody into the vision that it once had? Is that what being Biz Stone means?
I think so. I think. You know, he feels like the kind of guy that everyone can get along with, right? Yeah. And he's probably not going to be someone who's in there looking for money and a lot of power or anything like that. Like, he's not someone who has to come in and say, I really need to prove myself by taking over this team or this project or whatever it may be. At least this is my experience with him and kind of my takeaway from this whole thing. Obviously, once he gets in the door, it'll be maybe a little bit different. But I think when he says, like, my job is to be Biz Stone, I mean, he's funny. He's positive. He's rah-rah. He believes in Twitter. And his job is to go in there and do all of those things. It's not to fix all of Twitter's problems, but to be someone who people can look to for inspiration, I suppose.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that was mentioned in his Medium post announcing this change was that he had made some connections over the years, and he was actually lined up to take another job, but Twitter being the most important work of his life, kind of he couldn't really say no to that. So do you have any idea what he gave up to take this job at Twitter?
I don't know. My initial gut was that this was a Pinterest job, right? That he was going to advise Pinterest co-founder Evan Sharp and who's heads all of their product and was going to be more involved in what Pinterest is doing, which I thought was interesting at the time because, again, here's someone who saw, you know, a maturation, if you want to call it that, of Twitter over the years, and Pinterest is going through its own growth at the moment. So that was my initial thought, but I don't know, because now it sounds like he's still going to advise Pinterest, even in his role at Twitter. So he's not really giving up that advisor job, which is what I thought maybe this was referring to. I have a tough time picturing Biz as just like your run-of-the-mill venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. I could be totally wrong. Maybe he had a gig lined up at a VC firm. I can try and find out. But my guess is, you know, that was my gut reaction was the Pinterest thing. So this is a really long way of me saying I actually don't know exactly what he gave up for this, but he's still doing Pinterest and Twitter at the same time.
And I mean, Wall Street almost immediately responded pretty favorably. The stock price in trading kind of jumped up, settled down a little bit since then. Yeah. But still, that's like an early sign that they approved.
A baby biz bump there a little bit, yeah. You know, yeah. Not too big.
So that might be a good indicator longer term about their kind of feelings. I don't know, their positive reaction to the news. So.
I'd like to meet someone who's, you know, reads this and says, I'm going to pour more money into Twitter as a result. I just don't know. I really have enjoyed chatting with Biz over the years. I have no problems with him coming back. I just don't know, you know, where folks are looking and saying, hey, this is worth buying the stock again. But Wall Street reacts to a lot of different things in a lot of different ways that I don't understand. So, maybe it was just that initial excitement around having some positive news for Twitter, right. Which doesn't always happen. So.
Yeah, which would explain why it jumped up and then it calmed settled down back down again. It was like, oh, yeah, we're excited, but not that excited. Kurt Wagner with Recode, always great to get you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, guys. Take care.
Kurt Wagner 8 on Twitter to follow Kurt all over the internet. All right, have a good night.
Bye.
All right, time for a little feedback. Scott Remick wrote in to TNT at twit.tv regarding our story yesterday involving Netflix ending app support for rooted Android phones. Scott wrote, "Let's be quite clear here. Rooted phones are not the source of pirated TV and movie content on the internet. While it's quite possible that Netflix is doing this due to pressure from the studios, the reality is that this accomplishes nothing but making the studios falsely feel good while inconveniencing a group of users, most of whom are doing nothing nefarious. I have rooted every Android phone I've ever owned and will continue to do so in order to, quote unquote, fill the gaps, as Jason aptly put it. Whether it be to remove bloatware, fully back up all of my data, or get Android updates past the point that my manufacturer and carrier decide to support my phone, there are plenty of legit reasons to still root. You know what else is rooted? Desktop computers. And that is not changing. Netflix, banking apps, and these other things that are nonsensically banning rooted phones from running them continue to run fine on desktop computers without restriction. There really is no point in banning rooted phones when that isn't even the source of the issue they're concerned about." So, Scott, I feel like you made some really valid points there. Mm-hmm. There are, of course, you know, a lot of security concerns with stock Android, but right. Also with rooted Android, you're kind of going out into a little bit of a wild, wild west there. But, you know, at the same time, there are so many legit reasons to actually do this. I'm glad that he brought up the software support issues from carriers and hardware manufacturers, because all too often we do see Android phones not getting the updates as timely as they should, or even not at all. And that's a great reason to just go flash it with stock Android, which comes directly from Google anyway. So he brings up some good points here, but what do you think about that
idea? Well, I hadn't even considered like taking the idea of root access on an Android device and then transfer that over to a desktop computer, which, I mean, that's a really great way to think about it, right? Like, we don't think about these things in those terms necessarily when we're talking about a desktop computer. Yeah. Meanwhile, you can load up a browser, you can watch your Netflix in the browser. Yeah. Maybe there's certain DRM in the desktop computer that, you know, is equivalent to the DRM that's being that's being adhered to on Android, so maybe there is a direct correlation. But I mean, it's a similar scenario. How, on one hand, how is it that Netflix kind of makes the assumption that root on Android is dangerous to their files and therefore should be cracked down on? Personally, I have a feeling that this has to do with the relationships that they have with their content distributors.
He mentioned that this is about making the studios feel good.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a never ending ongoing battle.
Absolutely.
For the studios to, anywhere there's a possibility of us being ripped off, let's shut it down. And you know, at times it kind of feels a little bit like it's for naught, you know, because there are technology moves and changes, and there will always be different ways to get what you want and to figure that out, nefariously as it may be. But yeah, it really does kind of maybe seem like it. And if you're Netflix, and if you're in that negotiating space with those, content providers, this probably isn't a big thing for you to give up, right?
No, right. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, also, especially when you consider the amount of Android users that are actually rooting their devices,
it's small.
Very, very small. You know, section. Yeah. Happens to be a very passionate section of technology users, so they're very tuned into this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Just the problem is, at least for users like that, it ends up putting them in a Sophie's Choice sort of role of, well, so then what am I going to do? Am I going to give up rooting my device, you know, customizing all these other things so that I have legitimate access to Netflix? Or am I going to find another way to get my content? And that could end up shooting, you know, them in the foot, the content makers in the foot,
probably
in a different direction.
Yeah, in some ways this could nudge them into doing things they might not otherwise do.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah.
Good point. Well, coming up, the return of the hoverboard. But first, let's take a minute to thank Blue Apron, the sponsor of this episode. And reading this ad is probably going to make me really, really hungry.
Yeah, it usually does.
Even just hearing it always does. Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And I've been using some Blue Apron lately. It is very easy. I'm definitely in love with this. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card, which you can save after if you want to make that again, and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. If you spend a lot of time and money at restaurants or high-end grocery chains, you can now spend under $10 per person for a delicious meal. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. By shipping the exact amount of each ingredient required for the recipe, Blue Apron is also reducing food waste. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S., and there's no weekly commitment so that you can get your deliveries when you want them. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences, and choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. Bake spinach and egg flatbread with sautéed asparagus and lemon aioli. This is the part that always messes with me. Beef teriyaki stir fry with sugar snap peas and lime rice. Crispy salmon and roasted potato salad with pickled mustard seeds and creme fraiche sauce. I know I said that wrong.
It's okay.
Three cheese and baby broccoli stromboli with tomato and oregano dipping sauce. All this stuff sounds so good, and it looks really good on their website. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/TNT. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
The worst part is doing that ad read and then realizing you've got like 3 hours until you can have dinner. Great.
It's tough. It's tough. The struggle is real here.
I know. The struggle is real. Thanks, Blue Apron, for your support. All right. And TNT's fan of the day is Michael O'Donnell, actually a return fan of the day superstar, you might say, who sent us this photo of his studio. He's a big Twit fan. He's been here at the studio many times. In this photo, he says, "This week from my Sony bunker in San Mateo once again, four times the fun because I can, well, I can see three screens there. Are we on a fourth? Oh, I see the smaller screen underneath.
He is not messing around.
No. And are they, is it all the same show or four different shows?
No, no, it's all the same.
I'd be really impressed if he was watching four different shows, maximizing his time.
That would be a lot.
That's okay. Next time. We'll give you a pass. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. You can post it on Instagram, maybe put a face filter on it, Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we're going to find it.
All right. Mark Cuban, tech billionaire and owner of the NBA's Dallas Mavericks, is making a hoverboard scooter, and it's going to cost about $1,300. It'll be called the Radical Move, and it's going to be funded in part via a pending Kickstarter campaign. Unlike most other hoverboards, the Move is designed to be a bit more heavy-duty thanks to a unibody aluminum chassis with no pivoting center. It'll weigh about 24 pounds and have 9-inch wheels, which is a lot bigger than most rivals. It will go up to 16 miles per hour and offer about 12 miles of range in each battery charge, and there are settings in the board's smartphone app for beginners and an advanced performance mode. So it should make it easy for lots of different people to get into this. Radical, the startup making the Move, also says that it's considering their hoverboard to be a vehicle and not a toy. I hate that these are all called hoverboards because what I want is a genuine floating board that, like, with no contact to the ground, you know, a Back to the Future 2 style. But nonetheless, hoverboards are a thing.
Yeah.
And Mark Cuban's getting into it. What do you think about their vision of what a hoverboard should be?
Well, A, does it explode? Cuban says that it won't explode. He says they're using their own IP and they're making it in the U.S.
They're making it in Texas.
In Texas, right?
Yep.
And said in an interview like months ago when they were first kind of news that this was first hitting that, you know, everyone else is using the same Chinese manufacturers to pull this off. We're separated from that. So our hoverboards will not explode. So that's a plus. It looks like a tight package. I've never actually ridden a hoverboard. Have you been on one of those?
Poorly. I'm kind of curious as to whether or not the non-pivoting center will help a little bit. It's definitely something you can get used to, but at first getting on it, it was terrible for me.
A leap of faith. So on the old ones, I was reading up on this. It pivots in the center, so you turn based on how you like twist your ankles or you twist your feet on the board, right?
And this from the video we saw and reading up on this, it sounds like the Move, since it doesn't pivot in the center, it's going to have different sensors that will actually kind of have an idea of where your feet are at and what the pressure's like and kind of the way your body's leaning.
Got it.
So maybe something a little bit closer to like a Segway than the pivoting kind of thing. I do got to wonder though. I mean, I don't see as many hoverboards and I live in San Francisco where there's like hoverboards on every corner for a while.
You're going to see something like this, you're probably going to see it in San Francisco.
Yeah, and there are a lot fewer hoverboards these days than there were even a few months ago. I wonder if it's a bit late to be getting into this fad.
Yeah, that's true. And that's hard to overcome, right? When there were a number of these and in the news, it was, you know, time and time again, it was okay, great. Another exploding hoverboard story.
Yep.
Maybe that's the reason. I mean, and I think even on Amazon, they stopped selling them because of that.
Oh yeah.
So there's already like built into this category, there is a big marketing challenge of getting outside of what people may already assume about hoverboards.
Yeah. They've got the work cut out for themselves here. And that price, $1,300, it's not cheap. Like,
no.
I'm glad they don't consider it a toy because I don't know who would spend $1,300 on a toy for like that.
How much were the other ones? They were a lot less, right?
Yeah,
like $200 or $300.
And that's probably part of why they had so many manufacturing problems is they just didn't cost much.
Burke seems to think that athletes might spend $1,300 on this. Burke thinks that this is being marketed to athletes, which could be
I mean,
true when you consider Mark Cuban, Dallas Mavericks.
He hangs out with a lot of them. It would be kind of funny to see like an athlete like roll up to the press conference, just like, "Hey, how's it going, guys?
So, you know? What's up?
I'm done. No more questions.
No, I'm out here. Peace." Yeah, I mean, hey, we should get one of these in studio. I think we need to make that happen. Burke, order it. We hope you'll take one for the team. And we get a thumbs up. All right, good. That's
Burke,
what we needed.
Burke approved.
All right. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. Be part of the show, as always, by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW, and find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
You can share your thoughts on the stories we discuss in the TNT subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. And you can find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet me, I'm at Nate OG.
And I'm at Jason Howell. I won't be here tomorrow, by the way. You're going to be here the rest of the week.
I will be here except for Friday.
Oh, that's right.
It's
musical chairs all week.
Yeah, but I'll be here the rest of the week except for that. And then you'll be at Google I.O.
I'm going to I.O. tonight.
Myself and Stacey Higginbottom are going to do some like live play-by-play and color commentary for live stream for Google I.O. So
morning.
Even though you won't be here, there's going to be a lot of great Jason Howell content this week.
Well, and I've talked with Megan about possibly putting something together for either Thursday or Friday's show. So
yeah,
you know, we'll be in touch.
Yeah.
But thanks for filling in while I'm going to be down there.
My pleasure.
So you've got a lot to look forward to. Thanks to our technical director, Brian Burnett, as always, for pushing the buttons. Thanks to Burke for the occasional thumbs up. And, you know, helping out in the studio, probably the more important part of his job. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show, and thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody.
Yeah. All right.